Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1094, The Destabilization of China, Part 5, Pan-Turkism, Islamism, and the Earth Island Boogie. This is being recorded on October 22nd of the year 2019. In this program, we are going to be continuing with our analysis of the destabilization of China, and in particular what was described in an article by Doug Henwood from Covert Action Information Bulletin discussing NSC 68, drawn up by Paul Nitze, as a blueprint for doing away with the former Soviet Union. The corrosive effects of nationalism were described, and that is something that I think is also being applied to China. We've been talking about Hong Kong, and we are pivoting to the use of the Muslim and Turkophone Uyghur minority in the mineral and petroleum-rich Xinjiang province of China, like Hong Kong, semi-autonomous. We've spoken about the jihadist and pan-Turkist activities of Uyghurs in many programs, their affiliation with Al-Qaeda and the Muslim Brotherhood in For the Record 348, as well as For the Record program number 549 and 550. And we've spoken about them in connection with the Dalai Lama milieu as well, something we will be coming back to later in this program. In addition to For the Record 348 and the Going Native series of For the Record shows, the programs about the Earth Island Boogie are more than a little relevant, and also AFA program number 14. The relevance of pan-Turkism to geopolitics and also the machinations of fascist and pre-fascist networks is also something to which we will return when we continue our Fascism 2019 World Tour and talk about Ukraine, where the Azov Battalion is contemplating the founding of a foreign legion and had the Intermarium conference scheduled for Zagreb in Croatia. The Intermarium network overlapped the Promethean network that was founded by Josip Pilsudski. It was a sort of like a pre-Wackel, and the networks were ultimately absorbed into the Third Reich and then survived in the post-World War II period in the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations and related bodies. The Uyghurs again have links to Al-Qaeda, ISIS, the Muslim Brotherhood, and they are a major focal point of pan-Turkist activity being encouraged by Mr. Erdogan in Turkey. This is also part of the general phenomenon that we are seeing, yea verily, as I speak, in late October in Turkey, where Erdogan is taking advantage of post-Cold War politics and also the attempts at breaking up, carving up Russia and China to push a neo-Ottoman slash pan-Turkist agenda. That, again, is beyond the scope of just this one program to discuss. Numerous other shows, including the shows about the Earth Island Boogie, Pan-Turkism, AFA, aforementioned AFA 14, For the Record 348, and also some of the Going Native programs as well. Note as well, For the Record program number 550 and number 944 and program 1009, in which we spoke about the Habsburgs, their alliance with the Bormann Network and the Underground Reich, and their alliance with the West beginning in the immediate post-World War I period. Ultimately, the UNPO, sponsored by Karl von Habsburg, seeks to do to the U.S. apparently what is being attempted now with China and Russia, one of the oppressed minority groups, and they are indeed very much oppressed in the U.S. that is being cited by the UNPO, are the Lakota Native Americans who have been on the receiving end of brutal American policy for, well, at this point probably a couple of hundred, not a couple of hundred years, but I don't know when they, American soldiers and colonists first began entering Lakota territory, probably about the middle of the 19th century. But in any event, they are being royally screwed, and they are being targeted for agitation and ultimately, ideally, in terms of the UNPO and Team Habsburg, so to speak, for secession. And note that the Lakota territory is on top of the Bakken shale oil fields, and like Xinjiang province, rich in petroleum. And note that the pan-Turkist aspirations of Mr. Erdogan from Turkey include uniting Xinjiang province and the Uyghurs with Turkophone elements in the Caucasus as well, those being petroleum-rich Russian territories. And again, many of the Going Native shows, we have talked about Uyghur terrorism in China. Returning to the German foreign policy blog from November 15th of 2018, setting the sights on East Turkestan Part 1. Some critics will no doubt reject this as simply Chinese government propaganda. There is a fair amount of independent corroboration. My own situation is rather like the boy who cried wolf. I've been lied to so many times about so many things by not only our government but our mainstream media that I view their own claims with, frankly, a generous dose of salt. I don't assume that the opposite is the case, but would absolute drivel like Russiagate being foisted off on us. Anyone who believes what our government and our mainstream media say at face value without independent corroboration, again, I would not assume the opposite is the case, but they are simply a fool. Again, from setting the sights on East Turkestan Part 1 from German Foreign Policy, November 15th of 2018, Terror in Xinjiang. In fact, China's measures in, skipping down in the article, in fact, China's measures in Xinjiang are part of its anti-terrorism operation. It is a Chinese alternative to the West's war on terror, which, since 2001, has included the abduction of suspects to foreign torture chambers in Europe as well as elsewhere, and the use of drone attacks on suspects which have caused numerous civilian casualties. I will also cite in this regard what is going on at Guantanamo and what went on at Abu Ghraib in Iraq as well. Continuing. Since the 1990s, Xinjiang has been faced with terrorist attacks by members of the Turkic-speaking Uyghur minority fighting to secede this autonomous region from China to found, quote, East Turkestan, unquote. Some seek an eventual fusion with the Turkic-speaking countries of Central Asia. The attacks that became known in the West included a Uyghur terrorist attack at a coal mine in Xinjiang in September of 2015. The assailants deliberately targeted non-Turkic-speaking workers, especially those of China's majority Han population, slaughtering them with long knives. According to Western media reports, at least 50 died in the attack. March 5, 2014, 8 Uyghur terrorists, also armed with knives, attacked civilian travelers in a train station in Kunming, the capital of Yunnan province, killing 31 and wounding around 150, some seriously. There have also been recurring pogroms targeting Han Chinese. For example, in July of 2009, several thousand Uyghurs in Xinjiang's capital, Urumqi, that's U-R-U-M-Q-I, attacked Han Chinese. According to official figures, 197 people were killed. However, observers calculate the actual body count to be much higher. And bear in mind again that in addition to using Islamists, in this case Uyghurs, as proxy warriors, ultimately the neoliberal economics of the Muslim Brotherhood, who revere Ibn Khaldun, a 14th century theoretician, who is cited by the World Bank as the first advocate of privatization, loom large here. For all of the Orientalist trappings to a Western eye, neoliberal politics is one of the things that looms large in the background here. Again, from a section called the Uyghur Jihad. The Uyghur separatist spectrum is overlapped by the Uyghur jihadi milieu, who link the issue of Xinjiang's secession from China to that of forming a Salafist theocracy. Uyghur jihadis have long since expanded their radius of actions beyond China's borders. This first drew public attention when it was reported that in the War on Terror, which began in 2002, the United States had been holding more than 20 Uyghurs in their torture chambers at Guantanamo. The last of the prisoners were released only in late 2013. Uyghur jihadis have long since expanded beyond their Afghanistan engagement to other regions of the world. For example, the assailants behind a bombing attack on August 17, 2015 in Bangkok had ties to Uyghurs. And by the way, Grey Wolf elements, the Grey Wolves being the youth wing of the Pan-Turkist Fascist National Action Party, conducted some terrorist, a terrorist bombing or two in Thailand in response to Thailand's response to this bombing, beginning again. We spoke about that in one of our aforementioned Earth Island Boogie programs. For Uyghur jihadis have long since expanded beyond their Afghanistan engagement to other regions of the world. For example, the assailants behind the bombing attack on August 17th of 2015 in Bangkok had ties to Uyghurs. The attack was carried out at a shrine that was a tourist attraction for Chinese. The attack killed 20 people, most of them ethnic Chinese tourists. Uyghur jihadis' activities have also been registered in other Southeast Asian countries, such as Malaysia and Indonesia, from where quite a few continue on to Turkey to support the Islamic State or Al-Qaeda. One more time. The attack, this in Thailand, killed 20 people, most of them ethnic Chinese tourists. Uyghur jihadis' activities have also been registered in other Southeast Asian countries, such as Malaysia and Indonesia, from where quite a few continue on to Turkey to support the Islamic State or Al-Qaeda. Last year, China had estimated that up to 300 Uyghurs are fighting in the ranks of the Islamic State, while Syrian government officials set the figures at up to 5,000 Uyghurs who are operating in various jihadi militias in Syria. Regardless of the accuracy of these estimates, experts are certain that a large contingent of Uyghur militias are fighting within the ranks of Islamic State and Al-Qaeda. An analysis published by the International Center for Counterterrorism in The Hague warns that the Uyghur jihadi threat is largely underestimated in the West. One more time. An analysis published by the International Center for Counterterrorism in The Hague warns that the Uyghur jihadi threat is largely underestimated in the West. For China, this terrorism is that much more serious because Xinjiang is a strategically important region. That autonomous region comprises central sectors of the New Silk Road, the Belt and Road Initiative, or BRI project, currently Beijing's most important foreign policy mega project. unrest in Xinjiang threatens not only the People's Republic of China's domestic tranquility, but also its rise in world policy. This unrest is being systematically fanned from abroad. Turkey, under President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has assumed a prominent role. And again, this is what links what we're seeing in China and the full-court press strategy with what is taking place in Syria right now, pan-Turkism. And unfortunately, it's hard to talk to an American audience about this. You talk to the average American about pan-Turkism, even the average, quote, educated, unquote, American, they'll think you're talking about an Eurasian cuisine program on public television. Speaking of the Uyghur unrest, this unrest is being systematically fanned from abroad. Turkey, under President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has assumed a prominent role. While still mayor of Istanbul, and long before becoming Turkey's president, Erdogan had declared that, quote, East Turkestan is not only the homeland of the Turkic peoples, but also the cradle of Turkic history, civilization, and culture. The martyrs of East Turkestan are our martyrs, unquote. Uyghur jihadis have regularly used Turkey as a safe haven. In his talk with GermanForeignPolicy.com, the German expert on intelligence services, Eric Schmidt-Ehenboom, confirmed that Ankara's intelligence service has repeatedly, quote, sought to support secessionist attempts in Xinjiang. Uyghur separatists are active in Germany as well at times, even with official support, which sheds a new light on Berlin's most recent attacks against the People's Republic of China. The activities date back to the Cold War. GermanForeignPolicy.com will soon report.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at SpitfireList.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
And about those activities, we read, Setting the Sights on East Turkestan, Part 2 from German Foreign Policy of November 26th of 2018. And again, in our previous article, we took a look at not only Uyghur jihadism, links with Al-Qaeda and with the Islamic State, but also Uyghur pan-Turkism being supported by Recep Erdogan in Turkey as part of the same neo-Ottoman pan-Turkist politics that are governing his ethnic cleansing of the Kurds, in Syria, yea, verily, as we speak. From Setting the Sights on East Turkestan, Part 2 from German Foreign Policy of November 26th of 2018. For decades, Uyghur separatists under prosecution currently by the Chinese authorities in Xinjiang have had their foreign operational base in the Federal Republic of Germany. Exiled Uyghurs in Munich have propagated the secession of Western China's Xinjiang Autonomous Region, or East Turkestan, unquote, already by the 1970s over the U.S. propaganda broadcaster Radio for Europe, Radio Liberty. Since then, the Federal Republic of Germany has become, quote, the central outpost and the most important base for promoting the cause of Eastern Turkestan independence, unquote, according to a study on the Uyghur exiles, with Munich hosting the World Uyghur Congress, or WUC, the central outpost of a global Uyghur exile network. Its leadership is in contact also with Uyghurs in Central Asia and Chinese dissidents in exile in India, and maintains relations with officials in Berlin and Washington. A study presented by the U.S. military concludes that Uyghur separatism will hardly be successful, at least not with outside beginning again. A study presented by the U.S. military concludes that Uyghur separatism will hardly be successful, at least not without outside support. And that outside support is being given as part of the full court press strategy being exercised against China, in my opinion. Since the 1970s, the Federal Republic of Germany has gradually become, quote, the central outpost and most important base for promoting the cause of East Turkestan independence and Uyghur nationalism, unquote, according to a study on the Uyghur exiles. Erkin, E-R-K-I-N, Alptekin, A-L-P-T-E-K-I-N, by the way, whom we spoke about in, for the record, 547 and 549. Erkin Alptekin, who has been working for the U.S. propaganda broadcaster Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty in Munich since 1971, was one of the first prominent Uyghur activists in the Federal Republic of Germany. Alptekin could profit from his name. Prior to the 1949 founding of the People's Republic of China, his father, Issa Yusuf Alptekin, had been considered one of the leading separatists in what is today Xinjiang. He had been appointed Secretary General of the Islamic Eastern Turkestan Republic, which seceded from China in 1933, but which only existed for a few months. From the 1950s until his death in 1995, Issa Yusuf Alptekin had been active in Turkey, whereas his son was active in Munich as the de facto, quote, leader of the Eastern Turkestan independence movement in Europe, unquote. Erkin Alptekin has founded diverse organizations, including the World Uyghur Congress, or WUC, headquartered in Munich, over which he had presided from 2004 to 2006. The exiled Uyghurs in and around Munich were always seeking to gain influence on the policies of the FRG, not only by their demonstrations and petitions, but also through contacting members of parliament and ministerial officials in Berlin, with Erkin Alptekin playing a major role. From his Bavarian exile, Alptekin has also been lobbying in other Western countries. In the spring of 2004, he visited the U.S., where he was received by prominent foreign policy experts in the U.S. Congress. In the summer of 2009, he briefed the Human Rights Commission in the Italian Parliament. Alptekin also sought to foster contacts to Uyghurs in Central Asia. For example, in the spring of 2000, he visited Kyrgyzstan for discussions on the Uyghur situation of that country. The Uyghur minority is estimated at 50,000 members. In November of 2006, Alptekin was replaced as the head of the World Uyghur Congress by Rebya Kabir, a former businesswoman from Xinjiang. In the 90s, she had been one of China's most wealthy women and was holding political office. However, she was then arrested for separatist activities and, under Washington's political pressure, permitted in March of 2005 to leave China for the USA. She has been active within the structures of exile Uyghur separatists ever since. She was a candidate for the Nobel Peace Prize. At the World Uyghur Congress's Second General Assembly, November 24th to 27th of 2006 in Munich, she was elected president. In the run-up to this assembly, Kabir had spent time in Berlin, where she held talks also with German parliamentarians and officials of Germany's foreign ministry. During WUC's General Assembly, she received more than 50 congratulatory letters from high-ranking politicians, including German Chancellor Angela Merkel. In June of 2007, she introduced her autobiography, Dragonfighter, at Germany's Federal Press Conference in Berlin. In October of 2007, she was again officially received in the German capital. Kabir has also frequently met with high-ranking politicians in Washington, including President George W. Bush in July of 2008. By the way, in our next program, we're going to talk about George W. Bush basically giving the green light to the Hong Kong Shanghai Banking Corporation, or ASBC, to continue their activities not only basically dealing with terrorist-connected elements, including and especially Al-Qaeda. HSBC has also been a major drug laundering bank as well, and that is something we will examine in terms of Hong Kong as an epicenter of white-collar crime and the extradition law that was one of the ignition points, so to speak, for the unrest in Hong Kong. The next section, murders and Molotov cocktails. It remains unclear what role the World Uyghur Congress had played in the July 5th, 2009 Uyghur pogrom-like riots in Xinjiang's capital, Urumqi. That day, according to numerous eyewitnesses, thousands of Uyghurs allegedly attacked Han Chinese, destroying more than 200 businesses, 14 residential buildings, and setting fire to more than 250 vehicles. According to official figures, 197 people were killed, including 134 Han Chinese and 10 members of the Hui minority, that's capital H-U-I. According to the government, the World Uyghur Congress had been instigating unrest also via the internet, calling on Uyghurs, quote, to be braver and, quote, to do something big, unquote. This was understood as a call for violence. The World Uyghur Congress denies these accusations. However, it is a fact that 2 days later, following an exile Uyghur protest in Munich, two unidentified persons threw Molotov cocktails at the local Chinese general consulate. The same day, Uyghur demonstrators threatened Chinese tourists in Munich's Marienplatz Square. A World Uyghur Congress spokesperson was quoted as saying that he does not know who had thrown the Molotov cocktails, quote, but he knows that our people hate the Chinese authorities, unquote. On September 1st of 2009, the European Parliament's Human Rights Committee invited World Uyghur Congress President Kabir to provide information on the July 5th riots in Urumqi. According to the committee's protocol-like summary of the meeting, there was no mention of Uyghur violence against Han Chinese. There was merely speculation about whether the police had possibly killed Han Chinese by mistake. World Uyghur Congress remains active in Munich. A year ago in November, it had convened its 6th General Assembly with more than 100 delegates from 18 countries. German Bundestag and European parliamentarians were also on hand, according to World Uyghur Congress reports. Volkan Issa, ISA, a long-standing German resident, was elected president of the WUC. 1 year earlier, he had sought to visit Chinese dissidents in Dharamsala, India, in vain. Dharamsala is known as the main base of operations of Tibetan exiles. The WUC has always sought to federate organizations of all the Chinese separatists, including those supporting an independent Tibetan theocracy. And by the way, the links of the Dalai Lama milieu to the Uyghurs and to the UNPO, we spoke about in, for the record, 547, 548, 549, and 550, as well as the links of all of those organizations and milieu plural to the CIA. Continuing. A scholarly thesis presented in 2015 by the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, sheds light on the significance of Uyghur exile. The author, a major in the Pakistani army, concluded that the situation in Xinjiang will remain tense and Uyghur separatism, quote, without any external support and recognition, is not likely to succeed, unquote. However, it looks like there certainly is enough, there certainly is foreign support and recognition. Whether there is enough to actually begin the breakup of China remains to be seen.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Once again, from German Foreign Policy, this from September 12th of this year, 2019. The Chinese opposition's foreign hub. With its professionally choreographed reception of Hong Kong activist Joshua Wong, parenthetically subsidized by the National Endowment for Democracy, Berlin is presenting itself to the international public as the Chinese opposition's foreign hub. Wong was personally welcomed in Berlin by the foreign minister, and he demanded at the federal press conference that action be taken against China. Germany has already granted asylum to two other dissidents from Hong Kong who have been calling for the city's secession from China and have been indicted for their participation in riots. For decades, Uyghur separatist associations have had their foreign operational base in the Federal Republic of Germany, including one accused of participating in preparations of the pogrom-like riots which claimed the lives of nearly 200 people. German politicians are supporting Tibetan separatists as well, seeing them as a point of leverage for weakening the People's Republic of China. A Chinese writer who called China, quote, a pile of garbage, unquote, was awarded the Peace Prize of the German book trade. For many years, Western powers, including the Federal Republic of Germany, have been using the Tibet conflict as a point of leverage for weakening the Chinese state. Whereas some of the Tibetan clergy traditionally have been willing to cooperate with Beijing, others have been in conflict with the People's Republic of China. Their demands range from ever greater autonomy all the way to secession, with some even demanding the secession of, quote, Greater Tibet, unquote, which would not only include the autonomous region of Tibet, but Chinese provinces as well. Since the 1980s, a Tibet lobby has been established particularly in the West, in which the Dalai Lama, who is based in India's Dharamsala, plays a key role. Since the mid-1980s, the demands of the Tibet lobby have been regularly picked up by German politicians, with, in particular, the Green Party and the FDP-affiliated Friedrich Naumann Foundation serving as its mouthpiece. The Friedrich Naumann Foundation has also organized several international conferences at which the Tibet lobby could coordinate its political activities. At one such conference, an international campaign was organized attacking the Olympic torch relay ahead of the Olympic Games in Beijing in 2008. Managed by professional public relations, the campaign caused considerable damage to China's image. In September of 2007, Chancellor Angela Merkel ostentatiously received in the Chancellery the Dalai Lama, who was at odds with Beijing. One more time. By the way, I would note, we will review some of our information about the Dalai Lama, tutored by an SS officer featuring Nazi SS war criminals in his Tibetan government in exile, a man who is the opposite of what he has been portrayed as being, praised on, according to his top aides, originally from Germany, he prays on a daily basis to a Mongolian war god. One more time, however, in September of 2007, Chancellor Angela Merkel ostentatiously received in the chancellery the Dalai Lama, who was at odds with Beijing. Three German parliamentarians, including the Bundestag's Vice President Claudia Roth of the Greens, caused a stir in mid-May of 2018 when they received Lobsang Sangye, the president of the self-proclaimed Tibetan government, in exile. The West is also using controversies in Western China's Xinjiang province as a second point of leverage. There are two conflicts intermingling. On the one hand, secessionists have long been active in the autonomous region of the Turkic-speaking Uyghurs. They seek to have Xinjiang secede from China to found, quote, East Turkestan, unquote. Some, even with the idea of fusing with the Turkic-speaking regions of Central Asia and establishing a, quote, Greater Turkish Empire, unquote. On the other hand, Islamist forces have been on the rise since the 1990s in Xinjiang's social conservative rural areas. Terrorist attacks by Uyghur jihadis have claimed numerous lives over the past few decades. Up to today, the Turkestan Islamic Party, a union of Uyghur jihadis, is fighting alongside the al-Qaeda offshoot Hayat Tahrir al-Sham in Syria's Idlib province. Uyghur exile organizations have been active in the Federal Republic of Germany and agitating for the Xinjiang's secession from China already since the late 1970s. The World Uyghur Congress, or WUC, with its headquarters in Munich, plays a central role in the globally operating association of Uyghur activists. The Congress is being accused of having been involved in the preparations of the pogrom-like attacks on Han Chinese in July of 2009 in Xinjiang's capital, Urumqi, resulting in the murder of at least 197, including at least 134 Han Chinese. On May 8th of 2019, the president of the World Uyghur Congress, Volkan Issa, gave a report on the situation in Xinjiang to the Human Rights Committee of the German Bundestag. Among the organization's most loyal German supporters is the Green parliamentarian Margarita Bause, B-A-U-S-E, spokesperson for human rights and humanitarian aid of her party's parliamentary group. Alongside the support for Tibet and Xinjiang's separatists, Berlin has always supported those from China's middle-class milieu who are in political conflict with the Chinese government. In 2010, for example, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs explicitly praised the Nobel Peace Prize being awarded to the Chinese dissident Liu Xiaobo. That's capital X-I-A-O-B-O. A political program charter 08, co-authored by Liu, included many among the demands, one for the transformation of the People's Republic of China into a federally organized republic along the lines of the Federal Republic of Germany, which would entail a reversion of the nationalism measures undertaken by Beijing in the post-1949 era. Liu Jia, the widow of the Nobel Prize laureate, who died on July 13th of 2017, has been living in exile in Berlin since July of 2018. For a while, the dissident artist A. Weiwei, that's capital A-I, capital W-E-I, W-E-I, who moved to the German capital in 2015, has served as the key witness against Beijing. However, he is only seldom seen now since he expressed sharp criticism of German conditions and announced that he was planning to leave Germany. The German society thinks of itself as, quote, being open, unquote, but it feels, quote, itself above all, unquote, criticized Mr. A. That's again capital A-I. It does, quote, not really accept other ideas and arguments, unquote, and has, again quoting, little respect for unconventional voices, unquote. On the other hand, the Chinese poet Liao Yiwu, capital L-I-A-O, capital Y-I-W-U, who has been living in Berlin since 2011, remains loyal to Germany. In October of 2012, during his acceptance speech at the reception of the Peace Prize of the German Book Trade, Liao declared that China is an, quote, infinitely large pile of garbage, unquote, where, again, many regions and peoples are forced to be tethered together, unquote, and must be broken down into numerous mini-states. At the award ceremony, numerous prominent German officials applauded after Liao's demand that the People's Republic of China be smashed, Germany's president included. Last year, at the latest, Germany began to also make itself a name as an exile platform for the Hong Kong dissidents. In May of 2018, for example, the first two men from China's metropolis were given asylum in Germany. The two members of the Hong Kong Indigenous Organization seeking to secede the city from China had been arrested on the night of February 8th of 2016 for their involvement in the bloody riots in the Mong Kok district, where several hundred persons have attacked police officers with bottles and stones, wounding 80 and setting cars on fire. On Monday night, the Hong Kong activist Joshua Wong, again subsidized by the MEB, arrived in Berlin and was immediately welcomed by Foreign Minister Heiko Maas. Wong is Secretary General of the Democristo Party, which campaigns for a referendum where Hong Kong's future secession from China should be voted on. Even before his arrival in Germany, he had announced that he was coming to explore whether Germany would be a suitable exile for other Hong Kong, this exile country for other Hong Kong dissidents. In fact, there are numerous demonstrators facing sentencing for having vandalized subway stations and the local parliament building, attacked police officers with stones and Molotov cocktails, as well as setting fires near police stations. On the weekend, thousands of demonstrators called on President Donald Trump to intervene. Their protests correspond to the well-tested escalation strategy methods applied also, for example, in 2014 in Ukraine. With a professionally choreographed reception for Wong, Berlin is also making its mark as the Chinese opposition's foreign hub. However, the disparate milieu, who have found refuge and support in Germany, Buddhists from Tibet as well as Muslim separatists, controversial artists, liberals, suspected rioters, all share a single objective, to put an end to the People's Republic of China as it currently exists, and if possible, smash it. By allowing them to take the world stage and providing access to the foreign minister, Berlin is brazenly interfering in the domestic affairs of the People's Republic of China. The fact that the German government would itself categorically forbid comparable interference of foreign countries can be seen in the fashionable, although in many cases unproven, accusations that Russia interferes in the domestic affairs of Western countries. The scandal it would cause if, for example, one of the leading activists of the protests of the G20 summit in Hamburg would have been given asylum in Moscow, or if the Chinese foreign minister would have welcomed him for talks, is easily imaginable. Berlin's current interference in China's domestic affairs is being carried out in spite of Germany's role in the late 19th and early 20th centuries as one of the main participants in the crushing of the Chinese Empire, even including colonial mass murder. Although what was done then is hardly known today in the population of the Federal Republic of Germany, it is general knowledge in the People's Republic of China. And again, the history of Western imperialism, U.S., Britain, and Germany, and the support for the Kuomintang is well known in China.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
February 14th of 2013, also known as the Hong Kong and Shanghai Banking Corporation, HSBC has always been associated with drugs. Founded in 1865, HSBC became the major commercial bank in colonial China after the conclusion of the Second Opium War. If you're rusty in your history of Britain's various wars of imperial rape, the Second Opium War was the one where Britain and other European powers basically slaughtered lots of Chinese people until they agreed to legalize the dope trade, much like they had done in the First Opium War, which ended in 1842. And again, for the record, 547, 548, 549, and 550 will give you a good grasp of the links between Uyghur separatism, Islamism, Al-Qaeda, the Islamic State did not exist then, and the Nazi SS. The Dalai Lama himself was tutored by an SS officer, and Bruno Breguet, a Nazi war criminal who belonged to the SS and was part of the SS mission to Tibet, or expedition to Tibet in the late 1930s. He had some 130-some-odd Soviet prisoners of war of Asiatic extraction killed and their bodies preserved for anthropological study. And he was part, not only a good friend of the Dalai Lama's, but part of the Tibetan government in exile, one of the many ironies in this. Many of those prisoners so killed were probably of Caucasian and or Turkic extraction, the people now being exploited by the Pan-Turkists and the overlapping Islamists.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
The unrest in Hong Kong began over an extradition law that would have permitted the extradition of criminals seeking refuge in Hong Kong to mainland China as well as to Taiwan and other places. As we looked at in For the Record 1092, Hong Kong is an epicenter of white-collar crime. And among the criminal elements that is present in Hong Kong, is HSBC, a very large British-based bank that has its genesis in Hong Kong and has its a major subsidiary, sub-corporation, so to speak, in Hong Kong. One need only consult many of the articles referenced in the HSBC Wikipedia page to see that HSBC has been involved in major drug money laundering for the Sinaloa cartel, among others. It also has been involved with elements like the Al-Rajis of Saudi Arabia, linked to Al-Qaeda. It would not surprise me one bit if some of the Uyghur slash Al-Qaeda and perhaps Islamic State linked elements were receiving financing through the Al-Rajis and or perhaps through HSBC. But noting here the criminal activities of HSBC, not only overlapping drugs, but as we will see, jihadism and Al-Qaeda is one of the things to ponder in connection with the extradition law that was the ignition point for the unrest in Hong Kong. It eventually was withdrawn, but one wonders to what extent that extradition law, which was opposed by the Hong Kong business community, might have permitted the extradition of people linked to the funding of Al-Qaeda, etc., as well as to drug traffickers. The following article is from Rolling Stone magazine from February 14th of 2014. It's by Matt Taibbi, T-A-I-B-I. Gangster Banksters, Too Big to Fail. And skipping down, talking about the HSBC of the Hong Kong and Shanghai Banking Corporation. And note some of the history here, because the West, most Americans, well, most Americans at this point, again, couldn't tell a dirt road from a chicken with lips, but they understand nothing about China's history and the sensitivity the Chinese have to colonial activities by Germany, by Britain in particular, and as we will see in our next show, some of the Asian deep politics surrounding their war with Japan in World War II. Again, from Gangster Banksters, Too Big to Fail by Matt Taibbi of Rolling Stone, February 14, 2013, skipping down. Also known as the Hong Kong and Shanghai Banking Corporation, HSBC has always been associated with drugs. Founded in 1865, HSBC became the major commercial bank in colonial China after the conclusion of the Second Opium War. If you're rusty in your history of Britain's various wars of imperial rape, the Second Opium War was the one where Britain and other European powers basically slaughtered lots of Chinese people until they agreed to legalize the dope trade, much like they had done in the First Opium War, which ended in 1842. A century and a half later, it appears that not much has changed. With its strong on-the-ground presence in many of the various ex-colonial territories in Asia and Africa, and its rich history of cross-cultural moral flexibility, the Hong Kong-Shanghai Banking Corporation has a very different international footprint than other too-big-to-fail banks like Wells Fargo or Bank of America. While the American banking behemoths mainly gorged themselves on the toxic residential mortgage trade that caused the 2008 financial bubble, HSBC, the Hong Kong Shanghai Banking Corporation, took a slightly different path, turning itself into the destination bank for domestic and international scoundrels of every possible persuasion. Skipping down. In April of 2003, with 9/11 still fresh in the minds of American regulators, the Federal Reserve sent HSBC's American subsidiary a cease and desist letter, ordering it to clean up its act and make a better effort to keep criminals and terrorists from opening accounts at its bank. One of the bank's bigger customers, for instance, was Saudi Arabia's Al-Rajhi Bank, which had been linked by the CIA and other government agencies to terrorism. According to a document cited in a Senate report, one of the bank's founders, Suleiman bin Abdul Aziz al-Raji, was among 20 early financiers of Al-Qaeda, a member of what Osama bin Laden himself apparently called the Golden Chain. In 2003, the CIA wrote a confidential report about the bank, describing Al-Rajhi as, quote, a conduit for extremist finance, unquote. In the report, details of which leaked to the public by 2007. The agency noted that Suleiman al-Raji consciously worked to help Islamic, quote, charities, unquote, hide their true nature, ordering the bank's board to, quote, explore financial instruments that would allow the bank's charitable contributions to avoid Saudi official scrutiny. The bank has denied any role in financing extremists. In January 2005, while under the cloud of its first double-secret probation agreement with the U.S., HSBC decided to partially sever ties with al-Raji. Note the word partially. The decision would only apply to al-Raji Banking and not to its related trading company, a distinction that pickled executives inside the bank. In March of 2005, Alan Kethley, a compliance officer for HSBC's American subsidiary, HBUS, gleefully told Paul Plusser, head of his bank's global foreign exchange department, that it was cool to do business with al-Raji Trading. Quote, "Looks like you're fine to continue dealing with al-Raji," he wrote. You'd better be making lots of money," unquote. But this backdoor agreement with bin Laden's suspected Golden Chain banker wasn't direct enough. Many HSBC executives wanted the whole shebang restored. In a remarkable email sent in May of 2005, Christopher Locke, HSBC's head of global bank notes, asked a colleague if they could maybe go back to fully doing business with al-Raji as soon as one of America's primary banking regulators, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, lifted the 2003 cease and desist order. Quote, "After the OCC closeout and that chapter is hopefully finished, we could revisit al-Raji again. London compliance has taken a more lenient view," unquote. After being slapped with the order in 2003, HSBC began blowing off its requirements both in letter and in spirit and on a mass scale, too. Instead of punishing the bank, though, the government's response was to send it more angry letters. Typically, those came in the form of so-called MRA, matters requiring attention letters, sent by the OCC. Most of these touched upon the same theme, i.e. HSBC, failing to do due diligence on the shady characters who might be depositing money in its accounts or using its branches to wire money. HSBC racked up these "you're still screwing up and we know it" orders by the dozen, and in just one brief stretch between 2005-2006, it received 30 different formal warnings. Nevertheless, in February of 2006, the OCC under George W. Bush suddenly decided to release HSBC from the 2003 cease and desist order. In other words, HSBC basically violated its parole 30 times in just over a year and got off anyway. The bank was, to use the street term, off paper, unquote, and free to let the al-Rajis of the world come rushing back. After HSBC fully restored its relationship with the apparently terrorist-friendly al-Raji Bank in Saudi Arabia, it supplied the bank with nearly $1 billion U.S. dollars. And again, one can but wonder several things. Note that the al-Raji interests were deeply involved with the SAR network, that is S-A-A-R, all in caps, name for Suleiman al-Raji. That was one of the elements overlapping the March 20th, 2002 Operation Green Quest raids, and Talat Otman, a director of Harkin Energy, close friend of both Georges Bush, who gave a Muslim benediction at the 2000 Republican convention, interceded on behalf of the interests targeted, and ultimately Paul O'Neill was fired as Treasury Secretary, and the FBI, who had been involved with the raids under Robert Mueller, covered up the Operation Green Quest investigation, which went in the direction of the Bank Al-Taqwa, as well as the SAR network, the al-Raji interests. One can but wonder to what extent the cover-up of Operation Green Quest, and indeed the entire terror funding apparatus, is linked to some of the unrest in Hong Kong over the extradition law, and to what extent perhaps interests like HSBC and the Al-Rajhi Bank are helping to finance Uyghurs, whether jihadists, pan-Turkists, or both, in the targeted People's Republic of China. This concludes For the Record program number 1094, The Destabilization of China, Part 6, Pan-Turkism, Islamism, and the Earth Island Boogie. This is being recorded on October 22nd of the year 2019. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.